then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. From many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man beat chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's March the 6th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Greetings, comrades. I hope you're all beaten back this really brutal winter, okay? I've just read on Drudge Report that Niagara Falls has frozen over, so looks like the middle and the northern parts of the country are now back in the deep freeze, or the Arctic vortex, as the liberals are babbling, since obviously it's kind of hard sell to pass this off onto global warming. Anyway, that means that most of you are going to be occupied otherwise than with listening to Radio Free Northwest, and our listenership will be a bit down again this week. Now, I'm still puzzled as to exactly why that is. I learned back in the day from Matt Cale that the movement is seasonal, and I've found down through the years that it's true. Why that should be exactly, I don't know, or why it should affect the internet, which is where 90% of our activity takes place these days, again, I don't know. You would think that with everything all piled up with snow and a lot of people effectively shut in because their places of employment are closed or because they can't drive to work, unless you're actually without power, this would be an ideal time to curl up around the computer with a nice hot cup of cocoa or green tea or whatever and catch up on your racial internet, but that doesn't seem to be the case. When I say the movement is seasonal, which is true, it actually seems to be more of a mood thing rather than a weather-related phenomenon. Okay, I suppose moods can be related to the weather, but I've always believed that one of the tells that we're finally on our way will be when we not only get intelligent and motivated people involved in white nationalism, and with the Northwest Front in particular, but when we get people who are just as intelligent and motivated and active, both off internet and on, in August and February, as well as in April and October, which seem to be our high points. Now, we can't really be dependent on people's moods, and if a significant number of our so-called members or whatever disappear or go dark in July and February because it's too hot and they're too bored and listless, or they're too depressed by all that winter snow and the slush, then that's a problem. Another bit of that growing up that we all need to do. Anyway, enough rambling. Let's start with some housekeeping. I want to send a special shout-out of thanks to Comrade Jason from Oklahoma, who's the last man standing from the Colonel House Memorial Academy of the Cinematic Arts. Jason's latest video of my How to Deal with the FBI spiel of about 6 weeks ago was uploaded to YouTube and Thought Crime this week. As those of you who have seen the video agree, he's outdone himself this time. You know, I really, really would like to get this Colonel House Academy thing back up and running with at least half a dozen skilled video makers. We should be uploading new YouTubes every week. Also, I want to send another shout-out of gratitude to comrades Mike and Jackie in New York and Todd and Sherry from Kentucky, and thank them for the CDs that they've made, including a four-disc set made up of Mike's personal favorites from Radio Free Northwest, including the complete track of my reading of the prologue to Freedom's Sons, which is the only audiobook-type thingy we've been able to produce so far. Now, that prologue deals largely with the Battle of Portland, and Mike added in a lot of neat sound effects, artillery shells, machine guns, airplane engines, bomb explosions, so forth and so on. Now, I have a limited number of complete sets of the four CDs, but Mike and the gang did send me a number of copies of Disc 4, which is me reading the prologue, and for those of you who have always wanted the Northwest novels on audio, I'll be glad to send you one. When Mike gets a separate email set up, I am hoping that he will allow me to release it so that people can order his 4-CD Radio Free Northwest collection directly from him. Right, next I want to give you guys some updated comments on the situation in the Ukraine. After a week of Sound and Fury and hurly-burly, I think we still need to take a step back here and wait for the situation to clarify as to exactly who is doing what and why over there. Yes, I know about the so-called neo-Nazis, who appear to have taken at least a peripheral part in the street rioting that ran off Viktor Yanukovych. Now, the first thing we need to bear in mind is that the media's definition of what constitutes a quote-unquote neo-Nazi is probably quite a bit different from ours. Now, it is true that certain groups resembling our point of view do seem to have attached themselves to the Maidan movement, which is the loose designation of all the assorted anti-Yanukovych groups lumped together. It is true that some synagogues got redecorated during the revolt, which is kind of a long-standing Russian and Ukrainian tradition anytime there is civil unrest of any kind. It's kind of like an old-timey field sport in that part of the world. I admit, I always had a thing for the Black Hundreds. Yes, I have seen the YouTube videos of columns of 50 or 75 guys marching up and down wearing army field jackets and wearing what appear to be Soviet army surplus helmets, armed with clubs, including broken-off table legs, and carrying flags that I don't recognize, which may or may not be racial in nature, or which may be purely Ukrainian national symbols from the Svoboda Party, so forth and so on. Yes, I have seen the YouTube videos of various guys that I have no idea who they are, or how legitimate they are, or who they speak for, and if the translations are correct, they do seem to be saying some of the right things. But tell you what, let's wait until we see these same people marching down the street with Kalashnikovs in their hands instead of broken table legs, shall we? Let's wait until one of these so-called neo-Nazis is in the Ukrainian cabinet, and we get to see him bitch-slapping some left-wing harpy like maybe that lingerie model Timoshenko, like that Golden Dawn cabinet minister bitch-slapped that commie hag in Athens. Now, we want to make sure that these, whoever they are, don't pull a Golden Dawn on us and fold like a lawn chair when the heat comes down. Now, from what I can tell just off the internet, which I admit is probably not much, that revolution that they had a couple of weeks ago was fueled mostly by pure hatred and disgust for Viktor Yanukovych. And I have to say that from what I can learn about him, it was justified. Apparently Yanukovych is a corrupt bully and a real dick, and everybody all across the spectrum wanted him gone. But again, that doesn't explain who set this up, who financed it, who organized it, who these people in power in Kiev now are, who's signing their checks, and whose water they're carrying. I say again, we do not want the Ukraine dragged into the European Union. As distasteful as they may find being lorded over by Russia, as they have been for centuries, that's kind of like jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire. You can always gauge the character of a person or a government by who their enemies are. And I have to say that right now this new Ukrainian government, from our point of view, has all the wrong friends and all the right enemies. Now, this whole thing may have been set up in order to give the so-called Western democracies an excuse to confront Vladimir Putin's Russia. And what does that tell us? It tells us that the people who rule us are insane, because right now the West in general, and America in particular, is in no condition to be confronting anybody. America is on the verge of collapse itself, with 90 million unemployed adults in this country, and an economy based on accounting fraud. I will be following this with extreme interest. If Putin grabs the Russian-speaking sections of Ukraine and nothing is done about it, then it's official. The United States of America is no longer top dog in the world. Now, last week I played you part one of a speech by the late Reverend Gerald L. K. Smith, and this week I'm going to play part two for you. I say to you guys again, there are names from our movement's past that every white man and woman ought to know, and Smith is one of those names. I don't have an exact date on this recording, but I think it's from the late 1950s, judging from internal evidence and references. Again, I'm not sure, but I think this was originally circulated among the chapters and meetings of Smith's Christian Nationalist Crusade on a reel-to-reel tape or a mass-produced vinyl record.
Some years later, the most powerful Jew in America was interviewed. His name was Rabbi Stephen Wise, who was frequently referred to as the King of the Jews. When questioned concerning communism, Rabbi Wise said, quote, "Some refer to it as communism, but to me it is Judaism." End the quotation of Rabbi Wise. These two quotations cannot be denied successfully, and who can pose as a student of world revolution, and who can warn the American people concerning the threat against our nation without taking these quotations very, very seriously? In using the word Jew, I'm not dealing with the individual Jew. I am dealing with the policies and the programs of international official Jewry. In other words, what is the organized official Jew attempting to do on a worldwide basis? I can only judge these Jewish organizations by the conduct of their auxiliaries, which are functioning in the United States of America and in the nations of the world. And concerning these functions, I must tell you this. We have reliable information. Colonel John Beatty was one of the top men in the Department of Military Intelligence during World War II. Following the war, he retired as a military officer and took up his duties as a university professor. In fact, he was a university professor before he went into the government service as a military intelligence expert. He is now the head of the English Department of Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. This is indeed one of the important universities of the world. During the war years, Colonel Beatty was able to observe subversive activity scientifically and thoroughly. His conscience would not permit him to rest until he had summarized his discoveries in a book entitled The Iron Curtain Over America. Colonel Beatty did the most courageous writing job ever to be done by a modern man of letters. He produced a thorough, handsome, self-documented, cloth-bound book which establishes beyond any doubt that Jewish leaders who have migrated to the United States from Europe and Asia have seized control of many of our political, cultural, labor, and religious organizations, and unless their plot is hindered and checked and overcome, they will fulfill the warning which I quoted in the beginning of the address. They will lower an iron curtain over America. General George Stratemeyer, referred to earlier in this address, who was in full charge of the Air Force during the Korean War and who was a close friend of General Douglas MacArthur, came into possession of Colonel Beatty's great book, and after reading it, he wrote Colonel Beatty as follows. I am not quoting the full letter, but I am quoting two or three very important paragraphs. I quote General George Stratemeyer. Recently, I was called before the United States Senate Internal Security Committee, which came to Orlando, Florida, to hear my testimony. During the hearing, I asked many questions to which I did not know the answers. The gentleman who read most of the transcript in the September 3rd issue of the United States News and World Report sent me a copy of your great book, The Iron Curtain Over America, which he said would answer my question. I want to tell you, Colonel Beatty, that your book did answer my questions. Of course, I have spent all my life in the service, and it's hard to believe that we had and have such traitors in our country, and who still go scot-free. End the quotation, taken from the letter written by General George Stratemeyer to Colonel John Beatty. What is the deadly truth which General Stratemeyer found in Colonel Beatty's book? And why are these powerful Jewish organizations so determined that this truth shall not reach our people? I have no desire to be melodramatic, but I owe it to the listener to give him some sample of the desperation in the minds of those who are determined that this truth shall not reach you and others. Less than 10 days before this address was prepared, I received a letter through the mail, which is only a sample of many I have received. It reads in part as follows. I quote from this anonymous letter. Gerald Smith, you have less than 30 days to live. We will wash the United States with your blood. We will get you when you least expect. End the quotation. True enough, it is logical to conclude that it was written by a crackpot, a neurotic. But how much worse is the statement that I have just quoted than the one I am about to quote, which was taken from the Jewish Sentinel in Chicago, which indeed is the largest English-language Jewish newspaper in America. The statement I am about to quote was written on the editorial page by the editor of the Jewish Sentinel a few days after Mrs. Smith and members of my staff and myself barely escaped mob murder by a Chicago gang after I had addressed a packed auditorium of patriots in the West End Woman's Club of Chicago. Here is what Mr. Fishbein, editor of the Jewish Sentinel of Chicago, said. I quote, "We intend to make it impossible for Gerald L. K. Smith or any of his ilk to meet in public places anywhere in Chicago. Let them spew their filth in sewers, in dungeons, in underground basements, not where decent people gather." End the quotation from the Chicago Jewish Sentinel. The largest Jewish newspaper west of Chicago is known as the California Jewish Voice, which is edited by one Samuel Gatch. It carries a feature column each week out of Washington, D.C. Among other things, this column recently contained the following words. I quote from the California Jewish Voice. "Although the Jewish defense agencies have spent years and millions of dollars to destroy Gerald L. K. Smith, he and his henchmen now emerge stronger than ever. Smith has never been in a more powerful position as he rides on the crest of his anti-communist crusade." End the quotation from the California Jewish Voice. Dear friend, what strange repeal of American tradition permits any group of individuals, regardless of their political viewpoints, to boast that they are planning the destruction of an American citizen and raising money so to do? Some time back, I was shocked when handed the Sunday morning edition of the St. Louis Globe Democrat, the largest daily newspaper in the state of Missouri. As most listeners know, that paper is the only morning daily paper in St. Louis. It carried a story which, in part, read as follows, believe it or not. The beginning of the story revealed that a meeting had been held in St. Louis, and then the story continued. I quote, "A New Year's resolution was passed by the group at the meeting to wish and pray for the death of Gerald L. K. Smith. One member of the group said that gangsters should be paid to bump him off. The same individual asked the group to donate funds to pay for Smith's death performed in any manner." End the quotation. These dramatic citations have been made not for the purpose of imposing my personality upon you, the respectful listener, but to give you, through my personal experience, some understanding as to why it has been so difficult for some of us to get truth to you and other sincere Americans. Your first thought is to say, but why haven't we been told these things? The reason is simple. You have depended upon the newspapers, the radio, the television. These are controlled and largely influenced by Jewish ownership and Jewish advertisers. We must admit this reality. Certain Jewish organizations of great power confessed in their annual reports 3 years ago that they had raised over $6 million with which to oppose and fight such people as Gerald L. K. Smith and others. That's why the American people are puzzled. They hear much about the what of communism and the nature of communism and the program of communism. But most of our public figures are afraid, yes, they are actually afraid, to tell the people about the who of communism. Well, has the scripture said, quote, "By their fruits ye shall know them," end quote. It is only natural that the innocent American should say, "Mr. Smith, do you believe that all Jews are pro-communist?" As I said earlier in this address, we must judge the manipulations and the programs and the desires of the Jews by what their national and international organizations stand for officially. In dealing with this, I shall personify my logic by giving you the names of important patriots who have been opposed and fought and smeared by important Jewish organizations. Yes, not only important Jewish organizations, but all important Jewish organizations. Here are a few, the outstanding patriots they have sought to destroy. Charles A. Lindbergh, General Douglas MacArthur, Henry Ford Sr., Congressman Martin Dies, Congressman John Rankin, Colonel Robert McCormick, Reverend Charles Coughlin, the late Senator Pat McCarran, Senator Joseph McCarthy, Senator William Jenner, Senator John Bricker, Senator Jack B. Tenney, many others of similar patriotic stature. We dare not overlook the fact that every important Jewish organization in the world has fought the McCarran-Walter Immigration Act, which was intended and is still intended to save and protect our country against invasion by undesirable aliens. Every important Jewish organization has fought the Bricker Amendment, designed to protect our national sovereignty. Every important Jewish organization has fought every attempt to pass laws requiring loyalty oaths on the part of public officials and people who are being paid out of taxpayers' money. Every important Jewish organization has fought any attempt to expose the danger of Russian world policy, and they have favored the appeasement policy, which lost the Korean War and promoted the Geneva Conference, which allowed 500 million Orientals to be lowered behind the bamboo curtain of communist tyranny. Speaking of the policy of coexistence introduced at Geneva in 1955, at which time our president and his compatriots fraternized with butchers and savages, and speaking of that policy of coexistence, I quote for you a statement that was made 24 years ago by Dmitry A. Minulski, speaking at the Lenin School of Political Warfare in Moscow. He said, and I quote Minulski, "War to the hilt between communism and capitalism is inevitable. Today, of course, we are not strong enough to attack. Our time will come in 20 or 30 years. To win, we will need the element of surprise. The bourgeoisie will have to be put to sleep, so we shall begin by launching the most spectacular peace movement on record. There will be electrifying overtures and unheard-of concessions. Capitalistic countries, stupid and decadent, will rejoice to cooperate in their own destruction."
Okay, I know some of our younger listeners have been after me to play some more racial rock and roll, and so this is Race War with a song called Aryan Angel.
Comrades, tonight I thought I would talk to you about a couple of books that I've really had for a number of years now, but they go back to the days when I was involved in the collection of artifacts. And that's a phase that a lot of us go through, and like a lot of others, I went through it. One of the books that I really enjoyed from that time was Robin Loebsden. That was the book, Detecting the Fakes, A Collector's Guide. That, of course, dealt with militaria from the Third Reich, and a lot of what it said was really common sense. You have to look at the finish of an item, you have to look at the proportions, and you have to just use a certain common sense view of what would be acceptable at that time in terms of things like military medals and so forth. Now, the other book that I had from those days as an accompaniment to it was a book entitled Treasure Trove. This one deals more with personal artifacts. Now, the most fascinating thing about this book for me is the section on the paintings of Adolf Hitler. The paintings are primarily watercolors, although he did work in oil on occasion. Now, you have to understand that watercolor in Germany at this time was really taken very seriously. It has to do with really the era. You have to understand that in around the 19th century, for example, and moving on into the earlier part of the 20th century, watercolor had become very important, at least in German and English art, because back in the day when photography was still relatively awkward or relatively expensive to pursue, a lot of travelers would tend to work in watercolor, and one of the most popular ways to do this was to go to various sites where there were maybe important buildings or ruins and make landscapes of these important buildings. And one of the German artists that really did this to a great extent was an artist by the name of Rudolf Alt, who really became so famous and so successful as a painter that he was actually knighted and at that point became von Alt. Now, this was a painter that Hitler had become very enamored of. And this painter, like a lot of them, a lot of the watercolors at that time dealt with a lot of buildings, a lot of architecture. And it's hard to say what came first. Was it Hitler's love of architecture that made him so interested in the work of von Alt? Or did the work of von Alt make Hitler fall in love with architecture? I suppose you could argue it either way. What happened was Hitler became very enamored of this Alt, and really the paintings that he makes, in many cases, have a very strong influence from this painter, not only in terms of the sky, but because Alt was known for his cloudy skies and his depiction of a sense of weather in his paintings, but also for this fascination with architecture. Now, I tend to think that this kind of influence from another artist is kind of double-edged for a developing artist. You know, on the one hand, it's wonderful to have a mentor that you really look up to, and you can learn a lot. But on the other hand, sometimes I wonder if it makes it harder for an artist to develop an individual sense of style. So it's also interesting in this book to look at some of the landscapes that Hitler did, and he also did, on occasion, he did animal portraits. It's just interesting or nice to see him break out of the mode of doing churches or buildings from a distance. Well, of course, in his life as he got older, he didn't have as much time for art. But one of the things that he did in terms of his later works, he was engaged in designing, of course, the retreat in Berchtesgaden. What he does, he plans out the various rooms in this retreat in his later work, and so it's interesting to see him deal with an interior view, and he's very exacting about what exactly he wants for this interior. Now, there are certain characteristics of his individual artwork and how you can spot his paintings. Well, one of the things, first of all, is the cloudy skies, which is really a tribute to Alt. Another thing is the way he treats foliage. And I would have to say there's a certain abstraction, as odd may be to say, to talk about abstraction in his work, in his dealings with things such as leaves and things of that nature. When there is foliage, it's frequently used as a frame. But it's not, you know, there are cases, as I said, where he branches out into landscapes, and those are very interesting. But the foliage is very free. The other thing is that, and this is what became the bane of his existence when he wanted to get into art school, because he seems to spend so much of his time on architecture. One of the things that he seemed to not develop as much was this interest in the figure. And the type of art school that he was trying to get into was one where they were still very traditional regarding that everything had to be about the figure. And that was really the downfall of why he doesn't get into art school. Now, he was told that he should attempt to become an architect, but he didn't end up getting the opportunity to do that. The third thing that they say in this book is that they say that his use of color might be termed traditional, and while I would agree with that, it's hard to exactly define what precisely we mean by traditional, but all I could say is colors are muted, and you can't really say that the color choices are ever particularly shocking, but they're fairly soft. He uses a palette that I would tend to describe as somewhat warm in tone, but it does say that it's elusive because he tended to take suggestions sometimes from people on color because sometimes a certain patron wanted something to match a decor. You have to understand that he was painting for a living during the time when he painted most of these works. Another thing that he would do, at that time, apparently there were frame shops that were primarily interested in selling frames. And they would buy paintings from local artists in order to fit in the frame so that they could sell frames. Of course, when you're doing something like that, you want a paint that is, I suppose, fairly soft, and a painting that is not going to detract terribly from the frame. So I can see where you would keep a style perhaps fairly subdued in that event. Now, one of the difficulties that I would say that I have in discussing Adolf's art, or for that matter, the work of Rudolf van Alt, is that there really isn't a lot of information out there in terms of books. In terms of Alt, I mean, there is a book available on Amazon. It's certainly on the pricey side. And then I looked up a book about Hitler's art called The Unknown Artist, and that's extremely pricey. A lot of the reviewers of this book, The Unknown Artists, were under some kind of impression that Hitler was a really terrible artist. I don't know why, since I suppose most people, if they don't know anything about his art, I don't know why they would conclude he was awful. I know there have been some jokes about it. One of them, actually, in the movie The Producers. But ironically, that joke was actually by a character in that movie who actually was a big fan of Hitler, and so clearly it was very much in jest. Another thing that, of course, Hitler wanted was a museum in Linz. And actually, there's going to be a movie coming up called The Monuments Men that portrays the National Socialists as somehow wanting to destroy artwork and so forth, and that's actually not an entirely correct view, although there was definitely some artwork that they didn't like. But what would have happened to a lot of European masterpieces, for example Rembrandt's, is that they would have gone to the Linz Museum that Hitler wanted to build, and he wanted a wing for his own artwork, and of course, I'm sure, probably a wing for Van Alt's artwork as well. This is a subject that I've been wanting to discuss for a long time, but I've felt just hampered by the lack of information about it. Now, another thing that you'll find, of course, in a lot of Hitler's work is that he did a lot of church steeples, and these were gifts for newly married couples. He would literally set up an easel out of a church when he saw a wedding party, and he would give these various watercolors to people coming out of the church after the wedding. This is the kind of versatility that you have with watercolor. As I said, it's a medium that is taken very seriously in both Germany and England. Unfortunately, it is a medium that many people in the States really see as a secondary medium. Now, that's really unfortunate because it is a very versatile medium. And honestly, with the type of UV glass that they now have, although I don't know that that was always available, but they certainly have it these days, once you have an item properly framed, you can really display it without concern about the item fading. I just wanted to share that discussion with you, and I hope you enjoyed the topic. So thank you for listening, and good night.
The communist slogan is, "Workers of the World Unite." Now, Jack London was a socialist who rejected the idea that the Chinese in Vancouver, British Columbia, would practice solidarity with the white workers, such as, say, the longshoremen or dock workers. Now, let us compare the economics of East Africans with that of an American at the minimum wage. The average yearly income of an East African in Malawi is $200 a year. An American working at minimum wage can make that in about a half a week. That means that a minimum wage in America is making about 100 times that of an East African. Now, Tyson Foods wants to hire as many East Africans as they can and replace Americans with Somalis. Somalis are Muslims, and Muslims do not support trade unions at all. In fact, communists are on the top of their infidel list. Jews run the Communist Party, and who are the Jews? After Hitler fired all the Jewish government workers in Germany, they stated at a conference in Belgium before the war that they were the world's aristocrats and demanded that Hitler rehire them. Now, are you a worker that is stupid enough to belong to a socialist party run by the world's aristocracy? Somalis and other East Africans are scabs. Tyson Foods knows that such workers will cross any picket line because the economic difference is 100 to 1. There are other scabs that will cross a non-violent picket line. Jehovah's Witnesses will cross a non-violent picket line, but they will not cross a violent picket line. Mormons are also anti-trade union. Now, in the American trade union movement, outside the Wobblies, they have agreed to make it against union rules for any member to belong to either the Communist Party or a Fascist Party. The Necessity of Trade Unions, Chapter 13 of Mein Kampf. By means of solidarity and the collective threat of a strike, workers can negotiate better conditions for the workers and raise their standard of living. The tactic of the strike is a non-violent action. However, solidarity cannot be enforced by non-violence. The laws in America, such as Taft-Hartley, have made it illegal for a trade union to threaten workers with violence if they choose to cross a picket line. I remember a strike by the Steelworkers Union on the Thai Flats in Tacoma. The boss was a Jew, who would bust the scabs through the picket line. The strike lasted for over a year. On the other hand, I remember a strike back in England. It lasted only 1 month. Nobody, and I mean nobody, crossed the Trotsky picket line. Trotsky, for example, said that any worker that crosses a picket line is a traitor to the working class. He also said that the police enforce the rules set by the ruling class, such as the Jews. They carry guns in order to enforce such rules, and workers must arm themselves to defend the interests of the working class. Peace movements, for example, support non-violence in the belief that Jews and other employers can be persuaded to negotiate with trade unions. Whereas Hitler said, those that are not prepared to fight do not deserve to live. Employers have machine-gunned down workers in West Virginia. Greedy employers want everything for themselves. Bill Gates supports immigration for immigrants from India because Indian computer workers can be hired for a fraction of the cost of American workers. The African-American is 50 times more likely to commit a violent crime than his white counterpart, according to the FBI. The communists like to state that the racial difference is only small, whereas the economic difference is vast. Haiti is the poorest country on the American continent, but they are 2.5 times more better off than East Africans. If the white workers are replaced with East Africans, such as the Somalis, who are Muslims, they will burn down all the Christian churches and kill all the Christians. The employers, such as Tyson Foods, are not just traitors to the white race, but also traitors to Christianity and Western civilization. So the question is, do we just sit about and do nothing, while Tyson Foods and other traitors destroy our civilization? White flight is nonsense. In this world of eternal struggle, those that are not prepared to fight do not deserve to live. Now, evolution means that we must adapt and change to survive, so we must find a way to preserve civilization on at least part of the planet. Hence the idea of the Northwest Republic. First, we have to move to the Northwest and then fight to keep it civilized.
You know, His Lordship is correct. The original trade union movement, both in this country and in Europe, was very pro-white. They were very much against massive imported immigrant labor, especially from the Chinese, etc. So I'll tell you what, here's an old trade union song from the West Virginia coal strike back in the 1920s. This is from the movie Make One.
It were 19 and 20 in the southwest field, and things was tough. The miners was trying to bring a union to West Virginia, and the coal operators and their gun thugs was set on keeping them out. Them was hand-loading days. They paid you by the ton, and they didn't care no more for a man than they done for a draft mule. Them was hard people. Your coal miners then, they wasn't nobody who wanted to cross. So push come to shove, and pretty soon we had us a war down there in Mingo County, which in them days was known as Bloody Mingo. And that's where it all come to a head, there on Tug Fork, in the town of Matewan.
You can tell them in the country, tell them in the town. The miners down in Mingo laid their shovels down. We won't pull another pillow, load another ton, or lift another finger till the union we have won. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. There's fire in her hearts and fire in her soul, but there ain't gonna be no fire in the hole. Kill me before my working days is through. In a hole that's dark and dirty, an early grave confined, I plan to make a union for the ones I leave behind. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. Far in her hearts and far in her soul, but there ain't gonna be no far in the hole. There ain't gonna be no far in the hole.
There was a trial, but there wasn't nobody going to pass guilty on Sid Hatfield in Mingo County. Sid got married to Mayor Testerman's widow, and then the Baldens, they caught him, unarmed, walking up the steps of the McDowell County Courthouse down in Welch. They shot 15 bullets into him, right in broad daylight. Then C.E. Lively stepped in and put one right through his skull. Wasn't even a trial on that one. That were the start of the Great Coal Field War, and us miners took the worst of it like Joe said we would. It's just one big union the whole world over, Joe Keenihan used to say. And from the day of the Matewan Massacre, that's what I preached. That was my religion. We buried Joe Keenihan with our own. My mama, she thought he wouldn't never stay. But now he's with us, for always, laying up here in these West Virginia hills.
This Sunday is the 96th birthday of a man whom I personally believe to have been one of the greatest of all Americans, and so now I'm going to read you a commemoration of his life. I do not know who wrote this, but it was probably either Dr. William Pierce or else my former editor, Bill Grimstad. If any of you out there know, please enlighten me. George Lincoln Rockwell was born in Bloomington, Illinois, in the home of his maternal grandfather on March the 9th, 1918. His father was a very successful headline comedian from 1912 until about 1935. His ancestors were German, French, English, and Scotch, numbering among the many Revolutionary War figures and going back to Marie Antoinette, the French Queen. Rockwell stayed in Bloomington, Illinois, only until he was old enough to get out of the hospital when he was taken on the vaudeville circuit by his parents. He then spent some time in New Jersey, New York, and California, but most of his youth was spent in Booth Bay Harbor, Maine. He attended Hebron Academy, a prep school near Lewiston, Maine, after which he entered Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, majoring in philosophy. In college, Rockwell enjoyed and did well in the sciences and other objective courses, but fought blindly and instinctively against the sociology and other similar departments which, unknown to him, were then preaching the Marxist environmentalism and equalism which has played such havoc with our human biological sciences. Leaving Brown in the middle of his junior year in 1940, when it became obvious that the U.S. would get into World War II, Rockwell enlisted as a seaman in the United States Navy in Boston, Massachusetts. By the outbreak of World War II on December 7, 1941, he had entered naval aviation and became a scout pilot and a fighter pilot. He served aboard the USS Omaha in the South Atlantic and off North Africa during the invasion. He was then sent to the Naval Photographic School for pilots and assigned to the USS Wasp, and from there went to the Pacific Theater. He became a commander of forward air control operations for Marine Corps assault troops. He was at Guadalcanal, Guam, and other Pacific hotspots. At the end of World War II, he was commanding officer of a squadron in Hawaii, earning 9 decorations. Released from active duty, Rockwell attended Pratt Institute Art School in New York, working part-time in advertising and commercial art. In 1948, while still at Pratt, he won first prize of $1,000 in the National Society of Illustrators competition for a full-page newspaper ad for the American Cancer Society. Although still in the ready reserves as commanding officer of a squadron in Washington, D.C., he launched a new magazine, U.S. Lady, for the wives of U.S. servicemen. In 1949, Rockwell founded the first big national advertising agency in the state of Maine. Recalled for the Korean War in 1950, he trained Marine and Navy pilots in close support of troops and was then transferred to Iceland, where he became commanding officer of a squadron at Keflavik. At about this time, he became deeply concerned about the way all he had fought for in 2 wars was being turned over to communism. He noticed that almost all of the convicted communist spies and traitors, such as Julius Nethel Rosenberg, Nathan Silvermaster, Harry Dexter White or Vice, Robert Soblin, Morton Sobel, David Greenglass, Judith Copland, Harry Gold, Miriam Moskowitz, Fred Rosenberg, and Sam Cohen, who was chief of the communist spies caught in Canada, and most of the communist intellectual leaders, such as Herbert and Bettina Apthecker, were racial Jews. He was especially shocked to find that Who's Who in World Jewry, published by the Jews themselves, listed many of these atheist communists very proudly as Jews, even though Rockwell then believed Jews were just a religion. Observing that Hitler had said that communism was Jewish and that the Jews were out to degenerate and conquer the white race by subversion and race mixing, Rockwell bought a copy of Mein Kampf and read it, even though he thought he already knew what was in it from all he'd heard. He was astounded to find that it was actually a brilliant analysis of the mess Western civilization had gotten into and the only plan he'd ever seen for the white race to save itself. For a number of years, he tried to work with various right-wing organizations, all of whom believed, as he did for a while, that it was necessary to disguise one's belief in Adolf Hitler and National Socialism. Finally, disgusted with the emptiness, the weakness, the hypocrisy, and especially the cowardice of the so-called conservatives, Rockwell determined to attack at last, flying the swastika banner which had come so close to saving Western civilization and the white race. "Since our cause is fundamentally the truth," he explained to horrified friends, "I do not see how we can win by lying or misrepresenting what we are for fear of the Jews." The only time in the 100 years of the rise of communism that this plague has ever actually been beaten, it was beaten not by conservatives, but by radicals and fighters whom the enemy called Nazis and fascists, and whom they really did fear. Only in Germany, Spain, and Italy has communism ever been conquered. We are damned fools to be afraid to follow the only examples that ever worked. He hung up a Nazi banner in front of his home and dared the Jews to do something about it. They and their friends and dupes came in droves and mobs to do something about it, but Rockwell survived all the shooting, the rocks, and the other Jewish arguments. The publicity gave him a much-needed platform from which to call the attention of his fellow Americans to the increasingly desperate situation of America and our great white family of peoples. Rockwell believed that it was time for the white man to take America back from the aliens, the minorities, and the terrorists in power. To accomplish this, Rockwell believed that he had to win not the few in the right wing or the upper classes, but the millions and millions of our people. And to win these people, he had to offer them something besides a lot of empty platitudes about freedom and the Constitution. Only National Socialism offered a positive and progressive program for all Aryan people, rather than just the middle and upper classes, and combined a concern for the purity and protection of the white race with a fighting determination to stop all further mongrelization of our people. Within 5 years, Rockwell had led the Nazi Party from a tiny and scorned band of roughnecks willing to take to the streets to fight treason and race mixing, to a party which had headquarters in Washington, Chicago, Los Angeles, and most major cities, and commanded the grudging respect of the enemy. Even though there was powerful censorship of the American right to know what Rockwell was doing. Under Commander Rockwell, the party published the Rockwell Report, the Stormtrooper, and the National Socialist World, along with bulletins for party members only. Rockwell had plans to organize the White Guard, young white fighting men, to help protect society from the Black and Red Revolution, which had already conquered the police departments of Los Angeles, Chicago, Cleveland, and many other cities. George Lincoln Rockwell is the father of the present-day racialist movement in the United States and the founder of American National Socialism. For most of his turbulent career as commander of the ANP, Rockwell lived a shadowy existence on the fringes of the American political scene. He was misunderstood and rejected by the vast majority of his fellow white Americans, whom he loved dearly. He and his tiny band of roughnecks were alternately cursed, ridiculed, and ignored by the mass media. They fought street battles without end against communist and Jewish thugs who sought to silence them by force and spent many a night in jail courtesy of hostile politicians and police officers. Throughout it all, Lincoln Rockwell's warrior spirit of courage, idealism, and heroic defiance was never crushed. His years of persistence finally paid off in 1966 when thousands of white men, women, and youth in Chicago followed his leadership in a spontaneous uprising against efforts forcibly to integrate all white working-class neighborhoods. The uprising culminated in the now famous White People's March of September 10, 1966, in which hundreds of whites followed Commander Rockwell's leadership under the sign of the swastika. Tragically, within a year, Lincoln Rockwell was dead. On August 25, 1967, this authentic American hero was murdered in Arlington, Virginia, under circumstances which have never been satisfactorily cleared up. The trigger man was later convicted and received a short prison term. Yet, although Lincoln Rockwell died on that dark Friday in August, his heroic spirit lives on in the hearts and minds of white men and women everywhere who continue to draw inspiration from his mighty example. This is Saga.
The sun on the meadow is summery warm, and the stag in the forest runs free. To see the morning.
Right, since the country is going back into the deep freeze tonight, I'm going to assume that whatever it is about messy weather that gets white people disinterested in even internet racial matters will continue and nobody's paying any attention or in a responding mood. So what I'll do, rather than have a closing tirade, I'll answer some quick emails and do some more housekeeping. First off, Andy. Not our Andy, Andy from Minnesota. The answer is no. Secondly, James from Ohio, do me a favor and get in touch so I know you haven't offed yourself, okay? Thirdly, to a number of you guys, I appreciate your desire to sit down and write me long, long, long emails pouring out your souls to me and telling me your life stories. They're nothing I haven't heard before, but I still find them depressing and horrifying, and I sympathize deeply. No, really, finding out that there are others like you and that you're not some kind of lone freak and that there are others who see and understand these things going on around us, that can be a shock, and sometimes it all just sort of comes pouring out. However, please bear in mind two things. Number one, the Edward Snowden revelations of last year, which confirmed what we had already pretty much known for some time, that all email in this country, without exception, is now being intercepted, collected, and archived by the FBI and the NSA. Now, that doesn't mean that all email sent in this country is being read. That would be impossible. But I can tell you that there are few email addresses besides mine which are more likely to get at least regular auditing, as our friends in the silk suits call actually reading the private communications of American citizens without a warrant. Now, when you send me these long confessional letters pouring out your soul and your life experiences to me and all that sort of stuff, you're pouring out your soul to the Bureau as well, so you might want to keep that in mind. Secondly, if you do it anyway, please do not be surprised if all you get is the cyber equivalent of a monosyllabic grunt. Look, I know this is going to sound kind of sour and nasty, but one of the problems I have is people who conclude that because I alone that they have met or that they know about understand what's happening to them and I alone am willing to say nigger, then it follows that I am appointed by God or the gods to be their personal mentor and soulmate or BFF or whatever. Which is kind of creepy since most of these guys are other men, some of whom are my age. I'm sorry, I cannot sit down and engage in long email or paper correspondence discussing all the philosophical aspects of race and life and the whichness of what. What can I tell you, guys? Someday maybe we'll have a headquarters with a duty officer that you can call up and talk to at 2 o'clock in the morning. I remember those days. I had a lot of regulars. Okay, moving right along here, the fifth edition of the new party manual, the White Book, is finally out, and as soon as I can place a bulk order, I will start shipping copies out to those of you who are in what I suppose might be called good standing. Now, if you don't know whether or not you're in good standing, well, if you get a free White Book, you are. If you don't, you can order one for $10.28 from lulu.com. The link is on the Thought Crime blog for Friday, February 28th. Okay, I just checked Drudge, and just about everybody east of the Mississippi and north of the Mason-Dixon line is in sub-zero temperatures tonight, and large parts of the rest of the country are distinctly nippy as well, so I'm going to sign off right now and go take a walk out in the crisp 52-degree sunshine here in the homeland. That means our time is up, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week when hopefully you will have thawed out. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.